Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. For the second time today, most likely. Sorry about the whole missing a night yesterday. Which meant, of course, that there wasn't much time for conversation on today's chapter, because you had about 12 hours less. But we had two comments. I am Norwegian said, oh wait, first the discussion prompts. Talk about a ball breaker. And also, insulting someone's mother for shame, Anna. Not cool. You don't go for the mum, do you? You just don't go for the mum. I am Norwegian said, this basically felt like a repeat of the last few chapters, with Anna starting out with good intentions and then instantly jumping into combative mode. Very combative. Swim said, the mama fish, he said, I think we could all use a good laugh about now. New YA book dropping in March, Anna K, A Love Story. Every happy teenage girl is the same, while every unhappy teenage girl is miserable in her own special way. Meet Anna K. At 17, she is the top of Manhattan and Greenwich society, when, if she prefers the company of her horses and Newfoundland dogs, she has the perfect, if perfectly boring, boyfriend, Alexander W., and she has always made her Korean-American father proud, even if he can be a little controlling. This is perfect. I can see this on Netflix already. Meanwhile, Anna's brother, Stephen, and his girlfriend, Lolly, are trying to weather a sexting scandal. Lolly's little sister, Kimmy, is struggling to recalibrate to normal life after an injury derails her ice dancing career, and Stephen's best friend Dustin is madly and one-sidedly in love with Kimmy. As her friends struggle with the pitfalls of ordinary teenage life, Anna always seems to be able to sail gracefully above it all. That is, until the night she meets Alexia Count Vronsky at Grand Central, a notorious playboy who has bounced around boarding schools and who lives for his own pleasure. Alexia is everything Anna is not, but he has never been in love until he meets Anna, and maybe she hasn't either. As Alexia and Anna are pulled irresistibly together, she has to decide how much of her life she is willing to let go for the chance to be with him. And when a shocking revelation threatens to shatter their relationship, she is forced to question if she has ever known herself at all. There's an excerpt in the link. Oh, that's a real book? There is a strong possibility Tolstoy is spinning in his grave. Oh my God, that's a real book. Oh no. I genuinely thought you were making that up. It's a TV show. Oh my God. Oh, you're shitting me. I was like, oh, that can't be real. Is this satire or real life? No, it's real. Oh, man. I'm stumped. I am flabbergasted. That's worse than Bogan War and Peace. And that's coming from the author of Bogan War and Peace. Oh, I thought you were taking the piss then, Swim said the mama fishy. And I was like, even then I was like, I don't know. What am I trying to say? Like, I thought you were taking the piss, but only doing it in like a half-assed way, like just coming up with rubbish. But that's real. Oh, God. Chapter 26. Let's read, guys. Never before had they been at enmity for a whole day. This was the first time it had been so, and this was not even a quarrel. It was an evident acknowledgement of complete estrangement. How could he look at her as he had looked when he came into the room for the certificate, look at her, see that her heart was torn by despair, and go out in silence with that calmly indifferent look? Not only had he cooled toward her, but he hated her because he loved another woman, that was clear. And recalling all the cruel words he had uttered, Anna invented other words which he evidently had wished to say and could have said to her, and she grew more and more exasperated. "I do not hold you," he might have said. "You may go where you please. You probably did not wish to divorce from your husband so that you could go back to him. Go back. If you need money, I will give you some. How many rubles do you want?" All the cruelest words that a coarse man could say, he, in her imagination, said to her, and she did not forgive him for them, any more than if he had really said them. And was it not last night that he, an honourable and truthful man, swore he loved me? "Have I not often before despaired needlessly?" she said to herself immediately after. All that day, except when she went to the Wilsons, which took her about 2 hours, Anna paused in doubting whether all was over or whether there was still hope of a reconciliation, and whether she ought to leave at once or to see him again. She waited for him all day, and in the evening, when she went to her room, having left word for him that she had a headache, she thought, "If he comes in spite of the maid's message, it means that he still loves me. If not, it means that all is over, and then I will decide what I am to do." At night she heard his carriage stop, heard him ring, heard his steps and his voice talking to the maid. He believed what he was told, did not want to learn more, and went to his room. So, all was over. And death, as the sole means of reviving love for herself in his heart, of punishing him, and of gaining the victory in that contest which an evil spirit in her heart was waging against him, presented itself clearly and vividly to her. Now, it was all the same whether they went to Vozdzinsk or not, whether she got a divorce or not, it was all useless. All she wanted was to punish him. When she poured out her usual dose of opium and thought that she had need only drink the whole phial in order to die, it seemed to her so easy and simple that she again began thinking with pleasure of how he would suffer, repent, and love her memory when it was too late. She lay in bed with open eyes, looking at the stucco cornice under the ceiling by the light of a single burnt-down candle and at the shadow of the screen which fell on it, and she vividly imagined what he would feel when she was no more, when she was for him nothing but a memory. "How could I say those cruel words to her?" he would say. "How could I leave the room without saying anything? But now she is no more. She has gone from us forever. She is there." Suddenly the shadow of the screen began to move and spread over the whole of the cornice, the whole ceiling. Other shadows rushed toward it from another side, and for an instant they rushed together, but then again they spread with renewed swiftness, flickered, and all was darkness. Death, she thought. And such terror came upon her that it was long before she could realize where she was, and with trembling hand could find the matches to light another candle in the place of the one that had burnt down and gone out. No, anything, only to live. Why, I love him, and he loves me. All this has been but will pass, she said, feeling that tears of joy at his return to life were running down her cheeks, and to escape from her fears, she hastily went to him in his study. He was sleeping in the study and was sound asleep. She came up, and holding the light above him, looked at him long. Now, when he was asleep, she loved him so that she could not restrain tears of tenderness while looking at him. But she knew that if he were to wake, he would look at her with a cold expression, conscious of his own integrity, and that, before telling him of her love, she must prove to him that he was to blame toward her. Without waking him, she returned to her room, and after a second dose of opium, toward morning, she fell into a heavy but troubled sleep, without ever ceasing to be conscious of herself. In the morning, a terrible nightmare, which had come to her several times, even before her union with Vronsky, repeated itself and woke her. An old man with a tangled beard was leaning over some iron and doing something, while muttering senseless words in French. And as always in that nightmare, this was what made it terrible, she felt this peasant was paying no attention to her, but was doing something dreadful to her with the iron. And she awoke in a cold perspiration. When she got up, the previous day appeared in her memory as in a fog. There had been a quarrel. It was what had happened several times before. I said I had a headache, and he did not come to see me. Tomorrow we shall leave. I must see him and get ready for the move, she thought. And hearing that he was in the study, she went to him. As she passed through the drawing room, she heard a vehicle stop at the front door, and looking out of the window, she saw a young girl in a lilac hat leaning out of the carriage window and giving an order to the footman who was ringing at the front door. After some talking in the hall, someone came upstairs and she heard Vronsky's step outside the drawing room. He was going quickly downstairs. Again, Anna went to the window. There he was on the steps, without a hat, going down to the carriage. The young girl in the lilac hat handed him a parcel. Vronsky said something to her and smiled. The carriage rolled away. He ran rapidly upstairs again. The fog that had obscured everything within her was suddenly dissipated. Yesterday's feelings wrung her aching heart with fresh pain. She could not now understand how she could have humiliated herself so as to remain a whole day with him in this house. She went to his study to announce to him her decision. It was the Princess Sorokina with her daughter who came to bring me the money and documents for Maman. I could not get them yesterday. How's your head? Better? He said quietly, not wishing to see or understand the gloomy and solemn look on her face. She stood silent in the middle of the room, looking at him intently. He glanced at her, frowned for an instant, and continued to read a letter. She turned and slowly moved from the room. He could still call her back, but she reached the door and he remained silent, and only the rustle of the paper as he turned a page was heard. "Oh, by the way," he said, when she was already in the doorway, "we are definitely going tomorrow, aren't we?" "You, but not I," she said, turning round toward him. "Anna, it is impossible to live like this." "You, but not I," she repeated. "This is becoming intolerable." You will repent this," she said, and left him. Alarmed by the despairing look with which she had said these words, he jumped up, intending to run after her, but recollecting himself, he sat down again, tightly clenching his teeth and frowning. This, as it seemed to him, unbecoming and indefinite threat, irritated him. "I've tried everything," he thought. "The only thing left is to pay no attention," and he began getting ready to drive to town and to go again to his mother's to obtain her signature to a power of attorney. She heard the sound of his steps in the study and dining room. He paused at the drawing room door, but he did not return to her. He only gave an order that they should let Voitov have the horse in his absence. Then she heard the carriage drive up and the door open, and he went out again. But now he re-entered the hall, and someone ran upstairs. It was his valet, who had come for the gloves his master had forgotten. She went back to the window and saw him take the gloves without looking, and having touched the coachman's back with his hand, say something to him. Then, without turning to look up at the window, he sat down in the carriage in his usual posture, crossing one leg over the other and, putting on a glove, disappeared round the corner. Alrighty, there we go, another chapter down. Vronsky, you've got very few options left. I think ignoring her is a pretty natural next move, right? Because you just can't win, can you, buddy? Have your say about the chapter on the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.